and welcome to another episode of South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. On January 20th, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States of America, bringing to an end one of the most dramatic political transitions in the country's history. In another historic moment, Kamala Harris became the first female Black Indian American Vice President. Coinciding with Biden's inauguration, ISAS recently published a set of South Asia discussion papers titled Biden Administration and South Asia, which brings together various perspectives on the likely evolution of U.S. relations with the subcontinent under the new administration. Please do check the report. Today, to discuss various aspects of this new administration, we have Professor C. Rajamohan, the director of ISAS, in conversation with Ambassador Shivshankar Menon, a distinguished visiting research fellow at ISAS, former national security advisor to the Prime Minister of India, and a career diplomat. Welcome, Ambassador Menon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Prof, over to you, Prof.
Thank you. Thank you, Archana. And Ambassador Menon, welcome to this podcast with the ISAS. There was a time when professionals like you used to read tea leaves, whenever there's a regime change in Beijing or Moscow. But now we all seem to be so busy reading the tea leaves in Washington. There is a new administration. We know that even in normal times, it tends to be a coup where a wholesale lot of change of personnel. But now coming after such a controversial administration, there is a lot of global interest. And for the subcontinent, I mean, the importance of the US has always been there. But today, there is much greater interest in what's happening within the US and what it might do to the domestic and international politics of the subcontinent. So I thought I'll begin with the fact that, we've seen many of the new appointments, many of them are from originally, the Obama administration, and before that, some of them even from the Clinton administration. As Foreign Secretary, and then as the National Security Advisor of India, you have dealt with many of these people. So what is you think there's clearly a bump up in the level of competence, and what does it mean? How do you assess the new team that has been announced?
I think from our point of view, it's very reassuring. Sitting in South Asia, looking at the new team, especially the foreign and security policy team that President Biden has put together. Many of them are people, as you said, who we have worked together. We know that they have actually put a premium on expertise, on professionalism, on experience. And many of them have been hands-on in dealing with the transformation of India-US relations since the Clinton administration onwards. As Secretary of State Blinken said in his testimony, we've been fortunate that this process of transformation has been a bipartisan process on the US side. And Bill Burns, who's now going to head the CIA, for instance, was the Undersecretary for Political Affairs in the State Department under the Bush administration, under whom we finally got the NSG clearance, you remember, for civil nuclear deal. So each of them, I think we know, Kurt Campbell, we know, Jake Sullivan, we know, they've been to India. So to the extent that we now have experienced safe pairs of hands, I think it's very reassuring. Also the sheer competence. The other thing that I found very reassuring is that in all their recent statements, they have made it clear that they realize that the world has changed tremendously from the last time they were holding offices, high offices in the US administration, that this is not Obama 3.0. And I think that awareness is clear because I have not seen another team like this, which has been so open about their opinions and has published so many articles, whether in foreign affairs, foreign policy. I mean, you look at the last 2 years, and they have made their views quite clear. And most of those views are very reassuring, have resonances in our point of view. So let's see, I'm very hopeful. And I do think that the nature of the team that's coming should reassure most people about this transition. In fact, from the outside in, frankly, this is a team who, and this is not, you know, the transition might have seemed domestically very complex, but I think in terms of external policy, all of them have been conveying the same reassurance and the same steady sort of approach to dealing with the rest of the world, to resuming partnerships, to resuming business as usual. So that is useful.
We know the people, as you said, they're familiar, their views are well known, but the context is quite clearly different. I mean, there is a domestic economic crisis in the US, American attitudes to economic globalization. In fact, even many of the Biden team have talked about the problems in how the US needs to reorient its global economic policy, the renewal of great power confrontation. So all these are new circumstances. How do you see those affecting the approach to us, to the subcontinent as a whole?
For us, I think it's what we've heard so far vis-a-vis India, vis-a-vis South Asia, subcontinent, frankly, is continuity. We've heard that, whether it's in terms of all the testimony that I've seen, at least, whether it's from on the Pentagon side, whether it's from state. So I'm not sure that we need to worry too much in terms of declared policy. The question is really that there are so many critical issues and so many priorities that how will the administration assign its bandwidth? I mean, where will it put its effort? And there, frankly, it seems to me that all governments have been diminished by COVID, by the pandemic, by the economic crash. And it's not a bad time to actually catch your breath, look at the relationship carefully. What I find interesting and useful is that their listing of priorities offers huge opportunities for South Asia. When they talk of dealing with the pandemic, you know, here is something where India and the US should be working together on vaccines, for instance, on medication, on making it available like we did AIDS medicines, for instance, making it available through the world. And India, as a producer, as one of the major producers of vaccines in the world, has a huge contribution. They talk of climate change. Frankly, I see it as being in India's interest to actually move forward considerably on renewable energy, solar energy, on climate change itself. I mean, we have air to clean, water to purify. We have a lot of work to do ourselves, and it's to our advantage, actually, to see progress. And I think the Biden formulation of a secure and prosperous Asia-Pacific or Indo-Pacific, and they've used both almost interchangeably. Frankly, that's exactly what we seek. So I don't see strategic congruence diminishing. If anything, I see new opportunities in this new situation for us to work together. The third big opportunity that I would see actually is in digital IT, cyber, where frankly, there is going to be a lot of work to be done. And it helps that I think we will see a sort of lowering of the political temperature overall in the way that these issues are dealt with. If the Biden administration does manage to again, lower the temperature with Iran, for instance, that's something that would be welcome to us. Already, they've gone back into the Paris Accord. What they've done so far, frankly, these are all steps which, from our point of view, are welcome.
One of the changes, of course, is that, last time we talked on China's role in South Asia, today we're talking about the US role. How much more important China has become for the subcontinent. And China is also the central question facing the United States on globalization, on economic competition, and on security. So how do you see that dynamic between US and China playing out for us in the subcontinent?
You know, I do think that the consensus on China in the US has shifted considerably to a much more adversarial stance, to much more competition. I'm not sure that this administration will see China as quite the same kind of threat as maybe the Trump administration did, but they certainly see them as competitors and as potential rivals. And all of them have spoken of now being in an era of great power rivalry. So it's going to be interesting to see how they transform, how they actually implement that consensus on China as a competitor, China as a potential rival in what they see as an era of great power rivalry. Their answer to this, and this is across the board, is we will work with allies and partners. And clearly this makes allies and partners more essential from the US point of view, whether it's in the Indo-Pacific, whether it's elsewhere. So there again, I am reassured actually by this. By the fact that China is now central to so many of their concerns and that they will have to evolve the China policy. But I do believe that, frankly, this is the part of US policy which India will be watching most closely. And my fear is that we will take the temperature every 3 minutes and frighten ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an over-anxiousness in the way we debate international issues and less focus on these structural issues where, as you pointed out, those trend lines are far more, you know, sustaining and that they need to be analyzed more carefully. Coming to the specific regional issues, I mean, I think you have Afghanistan. See, for nearly 50 years, Afghanistan was one of the major driving forces of US policy towards this continent, starting with just a few years before Soviet intervention. Then you had the Soviet intervention. Then in the 90s, I mean, the rise of the Taliban, 2001, the 9/11 support for renewed alliance with Pakistan. So in a way now, is that chapter almost five decades of Afghanistan driving one of the major planks of US policy? Are we seeing the end of that phase?
I think it's over. And you've heard me say this before, Raja. I know I'm a minority here, but I've been saying for several years, if it were done, it were best that were done quickly, as Lady Macbeth said, that the US should just withdraw. And basically what the Trump administration has negotiated is a withdrawal agreement, which gives them some face. It's not a peace agreement. I mean, nobody expects this to bring peace to either Afghanistan or to the countries around it, especially to Pakistan and the others who have suffered directly from what's going on there. So, you know, the Biden administration is in the fortunate position of being able to pull out and blame any bad consequences on an agreement that they didn't make. So frankly, they should just pull out tomorrow. And frankly, that's the end of it. Yes, we have come to a new stage in this. And I think the worst stage is when we are between these two situations. But I think we have, I think, moved on. You know, it raises the larger question. The Indian sensitivity to this, and especially to the US commitment to Pakistan, has always been, oh, but, you know, because the US needs Pakistan and Afghanistan, therefore, you know, it affects us. But if you look at it, what has it done to us? I mean, when Balakot happened, what did the US didn't then therefore adopt a neutral stance between India and Pakistan. I think we also need to move on mentally. We should stop doing the hyphenation in our minds. The US has stopped a long time ago.
In fact, if you notice, I mean, Indian economy is almost 10 times bigger than Pakistan. Another 10 years, Bangladesh is going to be twice the size of Pakistan economy, which is contracting quite last 2 years and probably next year as well. But we seem to be, our debate is so obsessed with US-Pakistan relations. I mean, it's gone on since the 1950s. You know, so assuming US withdraws, you know, I can see the Pakistan relevance to the US will decline in the near term. But the other issues like global war on terror or other frameworks in which they could still matter to some extent, but that should not worry us.
I agree with you. I entirely agree with you. But I think we have, well, maybe not the best turn of phrase, but bigger fish to fry. Yeah. And we have other things to worry about. And for me, the interesting thing about India-US relations today is that they don't need the glue of China, they are bigger than these other relationships. They're not triangulated. They are important for their own sake. The US is our largest trading partner. If you look at our defense and security cooperation, our intelligence cooperation, what the India and US do together is very important to India. And then, of course, you have the whole range of other issues, diaspora, other links in technology, and so on. So, and I think there is tremendous potential in education, in health, in climate change, energy, and so on. And I think you will now have a US administration which is willing to look at those parts of the relationship much and actually broaden the relationship from a narrow focus on security, on Paul Mill, as it were.
The other interesting change that has happened, I mean, you would have noticed the Indo-Pacific document of the Trump administration that they put out, declassified recently, that the new interest in Maldives, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh, all deriving from a maritime orientation. We know that US has signed a defense agreement with Maldives. There's greater interest in Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, and taking an Indo-Pacific or a maritime perspective, that this looks like this is going to be an enduring phenomenon. I think the value, the location of these island states has dramatically increased. So therefore, a US that ends the continental wars and focuses on the maritime is going to look at South Asian waters from a very different perspective than the Northwestern frontier, which dominated all these decades.
I think maritime Asia, and especially Southern Asia, because it is maritime when you look at it, is becoming much more important. That doesn't mean that Nepal gets left out, because thanks to the Tibet border and the state of US-China relations, Nepal also, you'll notice, figures in the Indo-Pacific strategy and has been courted by the US recently for the last few years. So it'll be, for me, we are now in a situation where the subcontinent is close to the center of political gravity. We are next to all the major flashpoints. We are important to the central fault line in the international system, which is between China and the US. Unlike the Cold War, when all that was happening, Fulda Gap in Europe, somewhere else, and the subcontinent, frankly, was a geopolitical sideshow, which was very good. It gave us time and space to do what we needed to at home. But this is a very different situation. And this is true for all of us. So I think the easy options of closing our eyes and ignoring the world and relying on ourselves and turning inwards, autarky and so on, I think whether political or economic, I think are no longer available to us. So whether we like it or not, we are part today of this new geopolitics, and we will matter to the US in ways that we did not in the past. And this is not just India because of her size, but it's also all the others in the subcontinent, particularly the maritime Southern Asia.
You mentioned Nepal and Tibet and Bhutan, of course. I mean, I was just about to come to that. I mean, the Himalayan belt was, you know, when the 1960s, late 1950s, 1960s, when India-China conflict and the US came in for a short while. And then the US-China normalized the relationship. Today, the US-China relationship has become complicated. The Chinese-American interest in Xinjiang and Tibet has increased. So in a way, the Himalayan, the inner Asian belt that borders China and us, that is, in a sense, going to be quite turbulent. I mean, and this way, the Chinese Belt and Road, at least the belt, connects with the Indo-Pacific. And the Chinese road through the seas also intersects with the Pacific. So the Himalayan dynamic, how do you see that changing under the new administration and what it means for us?
Well, I think we have to recognize that there is tremendous fatigue with Asian land wars. And this is, and this is a broader phenomenon. It's not just Iraq and Afghanistan, but all the way back to Vietnam, Korea. And I'm not sure that the US will bother about these things to the extent that they affect the global order and their ability to pursue their interests, which is today primarily their own economic well-being, getting over the pandemic, and the relationship with the other major powers and preventing the rise of a peer competitor in China. So given that, my own feeling is that the US will rely much more on other partners, allies, et cetera, to deal with what happens on the Asian continent itself. The rimlands, the maritime rimlands, she will deal with directly. But I don't see the US getting involved again. We saw what happened between, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh, between Azerbaijan, Armenia. And I have a feeling that's going to be the sort of pattern that we see in the future. China is trying to consolidate the Eurasian landmass under new management. And we'll have to sort that out with Russia primarily, but also with regional actors like Iran, like Turkey, and others who are regional powers. And I'm not sure that that's going to be so easy. So long as it's just building roads and putting money and investing in infrastructure, everybody will welcome it. But when it then translates into political and other kinds of influence and creates outcomes, then I think we're going to see some. I think it's going to be interesting, to put it mildly. It's not going to be, but it will not gather the sort of US involvement, I think, that we maybe were used to in the past.
Now, you earlier mentioned briefly on how the defense and security cooperation between India and the US has significantly increased. There are new frameworks like Quad. There is the new talk about a kind of broader coalition, let's say, on the technology front of a democracy 10, you call it, or G7 plus 3. So there is actually a wider coalition, both on the security, techno, economic sense as well. But is India, I mean, you've seen India, is it really ready for coalitions in a serious way? I mean, it's not its tradition, but there is attempted change, but can it really handle playing coalitions? We've never been part of, always a lone ranger.
I think, you know, we need to get our various, legs to walk together. You know, you can't run a political military strategy of coalition and working together with Southeast Asia, with Japan, with Korea, and so on, if you don't have an economic leg to stand on, if you're walking away from RCEP. So I've argued this for some time, that we have to integrate the various ways in which we interact. I think the political, military, security cooperation, defense cooperation that we've done over the last 15 years or so with our neighbors in Tuwar East has really grown manifold. But the economic relationship hasn't kept up with that. Has not grown as fast, if anything. And COVID, I think, has reduced everybody's capacity, but certainly Indian capacity or interest in actually, and confidence in working with others. And that worries me. But I think I would say there's a debate going on in India, certainly. And let's see where this goes. You know, we might be slow and we might argue and we might look very confused, but ultimately we end up doing the right thing. And I'm sure we will probably do that again here.
The same was said about the Americans by Churchill. Everything else possible before doing the right thing.
On the
expanded defense cooperation with the US now, and we tried to keep our Russian connection alive, but now, we talked about U.S.-China relationship, but there's a U.S.-Russia relationship, which also seems to be getting into trouble, but we've also seen the START treaty extended. So managing that, you know, impact of U.S.-Russia relationship on the kind of multi-alignment strategy or whatever you call it that we've been doing.
Yeah, this is a case where, you know, that's one case, U.S.-Russia relations, where I do think this administration comes with some baggage and memories from previous administrations. And frankly, it is hardwired in the US establishment, Russia as an adversary, Russia as a rival. If you actually consider it, Russia is not an economic rival. She's not really a political rival. And she's been driven into the Chinese arms by things what happened in the Ukraine, by various color revolutions, by this conviction that, you know, NATO, the EU are pushing in the near abroad against her. So I am not sure. For the first time in the last year, you've heard mainstream establishment voices saying, this doesn't make sense. If your rivalry is with China, then why are you pushing the Russians into their arms? So I'd like to see how this evolves. Whether, and this is the one area where I think they need to realize that the world has changed and where maybe the old prescriptions don't work. And in other areas, I think they've got it, but let's see. I think that's another big open question.
As you said, Russia never had any friends in Washington, and the structure of the elite, the only friend they had, probably Trump, was hemmed in by the pretend he was not a friend. So I think
his own incompetence made it useless.
Yeah,
basically.
So it is really, I think, some ways, strategies about defining priorities, which you saw that happen, that it could actually, they could go to China, communist China, to deal with communist Russia. But that transition probably will take a lot more time this time around.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Kissinger told Nixon, if you look at the transcript, the tapes, he told Nixon that in 25 years from now, some other administration will have to do with Russia what we are doing with China. He actually said it in 1971. And it's the fact is they forgot to do it.
Yeah.
They just kept going and let China rise. In fact, supported China's rise.
I think one great thing there was the economic thing, right? I mean, just the integration of the Chinese economy with American economy, or Chinese capitalism with American capitalism, that's kind of created a block, which I think the struggle to undo that decoupling, whatever you call it, is going to be, that's been very hard. Because today, if you look at the US, the Wall Street wants to go back and Chinese are teasing the finance firms. Silicon Valley loves China now. So it's going to be, and these people all supported Biden's return. So it's going to be
a complicated dance because you look at finance, for instance. China is simultaneously putting in place the means to separate or create autonomy from the US financial system, to settle payments without having to go through the US dollar, without having to go through SWIFT. She's investing in a digital currency of her own. She is slowly creating means so that not everything has to go through New York. So it's going to be interesting to see at what stage does Wall Street realize that, yes, but Shanghai is being created as an alternative to us, not just as an extension. It's not Wall Street 2. So it's going to be interesting to see. It's the same in technology, because I do think that the last few years have convinced the Chinese, just as the Taiwan Straits crisis in 96 convinced them that they needed to change the military balance and create their own ability. And you saw the naval buildup, you saw the South China Sea. Same thing has happened in technology and finance and in economic sense. So when they talk of dual circulation, self-reliance, it seems to me that they are creating an alternate order of their own. They've done it already on the internet and the web and cyberspace. And so it's going to be more complicated. And there are structural reasons, therefore, to see China-US as being very complicated. Being dependent, Siamese twins, but also aware that one twin has ideas of autonomy and independence.
In fact, the Chinese have been decoupling for a while, and it's really the Americans who are unwilling to see it, and they still have a problem framing that. Well, the Chinese have framed it quite clearly in terms of dual circulation on the whole internet's evolution. There's a lot of concern in Delhi on the human rights issue, how the US will do this. Democrats tend to be rhetorical. But if you know the long history of the US, human rights was not separate from geopolitics. It's not that the US is some kind of a all-saints society that is there to save human rights in the world. As a realist, as a practitioner, you've seen that. So why is there so much concern? I mean, is that in Delhi, I mean, given the record of the US, they've dealt with communist China, they've dealt with Pakistan, they've dealt with
If we express too much concern, it looks like a guilty conscience.
Hmm.
So I don't think that's a very sensible posture to take, one. Two, it seems to me democracy is going through its own, well, convolutions, both in the US and in India. It's not, you know, after all, what we saw in the transition in the US is unprecedented. And the numbers of people who believe in old-fashioned liberal democracy in both countries have actually declined. And you are seeing different kinds of democratic politics today in both countries. So we have big internal issues about democracy that we have to sort out. So when somebody was saying the other day, oh, we're going to have a conference of democracies, I was saying to do what? To discuss how we live up to our own ideals? We're not here for the export of democracy. India's never believed in that. And I do think that the US is going to have enough work at home fixing its own democracy, living up to the ideals of the union, I mean, making it a better union, that I'm not sure that democracy, human rights, treatment of minorities, religious freedom, these issues will be dealt with very differently from the way they were in the past. The useful instruments of state policy, when you need them, but you can ignore them pretty successfully, even after Tiananmen or, you know, when it's Salazar in Portugal or Pinochet, you can live with those things. So I am, it doesn't worry me. But what worries me is when we keep talking about it as though we have a guilty conscience.
In fact, it's interesting actually, Biden's, I mean, if you saw the transcript of Biden's readout with Prime Minister Modi, he talks about strengthening democracy at home. I mean, he's not forgotten. I think they know they're aware of the current crisis. So when he says, look, we should lead by the power of example and not by the example of power. So it's not the same US in the sense that their own internal dynamic adds a layer to the complexity. And then we've seen
There's an interesting twist to this. It is in some ways the Indian diaspora which feels it has the right. And you'll hear much more from Indian origin American congressmen, women, senators, and so on. Because A, we make claims on them. So they have a right to, they think they have a right, therefore, to comment back and that they know better. And that is that sideshow, you know, of the relationship with the diaspora and how many claims you make on them and then what rights do you give them in return. That's going to be an interesting phenomenon.
In fact, that was my last question, diaspora has become a double-edged sword. I mean, that is not just, they have views, they have, and then it's a kind of the dynamic interaction is something that I think we've not been, I don't know if we've been prepared for it, but we faced those problems before, but this time the weight of the diaspora has grown, and the fact that Kamala Harris is vice president and there are more than 20 Indians in the administration, because the footprint of Indians, I mean, in all the Western democracies, whether it's some of them have become prime ministers in UK, in the cabinet. There is going to be some biting back, I think, which complicates the conduct of foreign policy as between two governments, because they're mobilizing political support in the retail politics in the West, and the governments have to do something about it. So you're
absolutely right about it being a double-edged sword. But I think this is good. We will learn as we go because it's necessary. And for me, the broader this kind of engagement, beyond just the pure statist one between the two governments, I think the better for the overall relationship.
Just one final thought. I mean, the Americans, you know, that they're not going to be able to do everything in the world in a way that regional powers, rising powers like India, I mean, I think can do a lot more in their own regions. So they're not trying to block you like we used to fear that they're going to stop you. But actually, nobody is stopping you from doing more things in South Asia or if it's your own neighborhood. So is that sense that, look, we have room to do our own stuff in a fragmented world? Is that drawing on Delhi, you see, from where you sit?
I think so. I think, and if you look at Indian diplomacy in the last 6 months or so, it's been much more active in the immediate neighborhood. Just if you track E.M. Jayashankar's travels recently.
To the Gulf.
To the Gulf, to Sri Lanka, to the Maldives, to the neighborhood, to Seychelles, foreign secretary as well, to Nepal, Bangladesh. You know, these are relationships which matter. And I do think we are doing much more. You look at Indian vaccine diplomacy. Again, it's concentrated on exactly as you said, the regional space within which new opportunities have opened up for diplomacy. And I think that's good. I think I'm glad that we are actually responding to this opportunity. I actually think that the crises, this trifecta of crises actually in our case, it's a relationship with China, it's the COVID, it's the economic situation together actually has opened up a whole new set of opportunities. And if we actually apply our minds to this new situation, I think we will maybe change our ways. We do. Crisis has a way of actually pushing us forward as it has in the past. So let's see. I'm eternal optimist.
Crisis too good to be wasted, as one of former democratic leaders has said. Basim Menon, thank you. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And we have had you visiting the Institute last year. Hopefully, things will improve and we'll be able to host you back here as one of our leading distinguished fellows. Thank you again, and we'll come back to you when we do something interesting like what we're doing today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Randa. Thanks. Good to see you.